Penguin Random House Audio presents Serious Face, Essays. This is the author, John Mooallem. Introduction. 20 years ago, I was working at a small literary magazine in New York City, screening the bulging slush pile of poetry submissions for anything that the editors might be interested in publishing. Please know that passing judgment on all these people's poems made me queasy. I was 22 years old, not especially well-read, and my only previous full-time employment had been as a kosher butcher. I could only like what I liked. Also, I was extraordinarily sad. My father had died a year earlier, and the grief and bewilderment I'd kept tamped down were beginning to burble upward. I felt alone, I felt lost, and I was fixated on figuring out why everything was so hard, what I was doing wrong. Some evenings, I'd walk the 58 blocks home from the office, excessively serious-faced, wrenching my mind around like a Rubik's Cube, struggling to make it show a brighter color. My point here is, I'm sure this made me less patient and open-minded than I ought to have been. Whenever I opened another envelope from the slush pile and found someone else's delicate clump of pentameter about pear blossoms or regret. In fact, of the thousands of poems I must have read at that job, there's apparently only one that I allowed to leave an indelible impression. And not even the whole poem, just one line. The poem is called Frost on the Fields. I know because I just went Googling for it and found it reprinted in an obituary for the poet, Eric Trethewey, who died in 2014. It's 23 lines long and describes a typical November day, somewhere cold and rural. An oak leaf still stemmed to a branch tugs away, and so on. There's a pond, a hillside, a turkey buzzard on a wooden post. But then, out of nowhere, there's a question. Why are we not better than we are? I've been thinking hard about any common themes running through the pieces in this book, or whether there's some secret theory that explains why I've spent almost my entire adult life so far obsessing over the process of reporting and writing them. In other words, why these? Also, why me? I'm tempted to say that it's all utterly random. But this morning, I suddenly remembered that line, "Why are we not better than we are?" and felt the clarifying, boneheaded profundity of it all over again. I'm not sure, sincerely I'm not, but if there's a question that all these stories have at their heart, and that a reader might keep wrestling with once they're done reading them, it could be that one. And just phrasing the question that way, why are we not better than we are, somehow conveys that it can't possibly be answered. It's just too damn big, like the sky. But that's only the half of it. I also remembered the particular moment in my life when I encountered that poem, a moment when I was trying to write poetry myself, but also accepting how unnatural the medium felt to me, and wondering how long I could keep pretending. Meanwhile, I was reading magazine journalism for the first time, starting to wonder what that kind of writing was all about. It wasn't lost on me that everything about Frost on the Fields, beyond that quick, explosive question, felt lonely and cocooned. The entire poem, and I don't mean this as a knock against it as literature, is simply a guy noticing stuff on a walk, in a landscape where hardly anything is moving, where no one else is around. Magazine writers, meanwhile, seem to be circling around the same kinds of questions, but only in the background, while they whip through our colossal, mystifying, stupidly beautiful world in rental cars and airplanes, the same world that I was feeling intimidated to fully enter. I knew I'd spend my life asking questions like, why are we not better than we are? Like it or not, and often I didn't, this was evidently just the way I was wired. But here is a way to channel that impulse that felt more doable to me and more fun. Instead of thumping my head against the biggest questions of my own life, I could go ask other people specific questions about their lives and then work hard to transmit whatever feelings I'd felt when I was with them and whatever insights I'd stitched together or absorbed. I'd been puzzling over myself, torturously trying to unlock the truth of who I was. The truth is, I am the puzzling. A House at the End of the World, 2017. First, the backstory, Because, B.J. Miller has found, the backstory is unavoidable when you are missing three limbs. Miller was a sophomore at Princeton when, one Monday night in November 1990, he and two friends went out for drinks, and at around 4 a.m., found themselves ambling toward a convenience store for sandwiches. They decided to climb a commuter train parked at the adjacent rail station, for fun. Miller scaled it first. When he got to the top, electrical current arced out of a piece of equipment into the watch on his wrist. 11,000 volts shot through his left arm and down his legs. When his friends reached him on the roof of the train, smoke was rising from his feet. Miller remembers none of this. His memories don't kick in until several days later when he woke up in the burn unit of St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey. Thinking he'd resurfaced from a terrible dream, he tried to shamble across his hospital room on the charred crusts of his legs until he used up the slack of his catheter tube and the device tore out of his body. Then, all the pain hit him at once. Doctors took each leg just below the knee, one at a time. Then they turned to his arm, which triggered in Miller a deeper grief. "Hands do stuff," he explains. "Your foot is just a stinky, clunky little platform." For weeks, the hospital staff considered him close to death, but Miller, in a devastated haze, didn't know that. He only worried about who he would be when he survived. No visitors were allowed in his hospital room. The burn unit was a sterile environment. But on the morning Miller's arm was going to be amputated, just below the elbow, a dozen friends and family members packed into a 10-foot-long corridor between the burn unit and the elevator, just to catch a glimpse of him as he was rolled to surgery. "They all dared to show up," Miller remembers thinking. "They all dared to look at me. They were proving that I was lovable, even when I couldn't see it." This reassured Miller, as did the example of his mother, Susan, a polio survivor who has used a wheelchair since Miller was a child. She had never seen diminished. After the operation, when Miller was rolled through the hallway again, he opened his eyes as he passed her and said, "Mom, Mom, now you and me have more in common." It wasn't that Miller was suddenly enlightened. Internally, he was in turmoil, but in retrospect, he credits himself with doing one thing right. He saw a good way to look at his situation and committed to faking that perspective, hoping that his genuine self might eventually catch up. Miller refused, for example, to let himself believe that his life was extra difficult now, only uniquely difficult, as all lives are. He resolved to think of his suffering as simply a variation on a theme we all deal with. "To be human is really hard," he says. His life had never felt easy, even as a privileged, able-bodied suburban boy with two adoring parents. But he never felt entitled to any angst. He saw unhappiness as an illegitimate intrusion into the carefree reality he was supposed to inhabit. And don't we all do that, he realized? Don't we all treat suffering as a disruption to existence, instead of an inevitable part of it? He wondered what would happen if you could reincorporate your version of reality, of normalcy, to accommodate suffering. As a person with a disability, he was getting all kinds of signals that he was different and separated from everyone else. But he worked hard to see himself as merely sitting somewhere on a continuum between the man on his deathbed and the woman who misplaced her car keys, to let his accident heighten his connectedness to others instead of isolating him. This was the only way, he thought, to keep from hating his injuries, and by extension, himself. Miller returned to Princeton the following year. He had three prosthetics and rode around campus in a golf cart with a rambunctious service dog named Vermont, who, in truth, was too much of a misfit to perform any concrete service. Miller had wanted to work in foreign relations in China. Now, he started studying art history. He found it to be a good lens through which to keep making sense of his injuries. First, there was the discipline's implicit conviction that every work is shaped by the viewer's perspective. He remembers looking at slides of ancient sculptures in a dark lecture hall, all of them missing arms or noses or ears, and suddenly recognizing them for what they were, fellow amputees. "We were, as a class, all calling these works monumental, beautiful, and important, but we'd never seen them whole," he says. "Time's effect on these marble bodies, their suffering, really, was understood as part of the art." Medicine didn't think about bodies this way, Miller realized. Embedded in words...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?